Hey, what's up, everybody?
Welcome back to Mile Higher Podcast, episode 292. Now, today, we're going to be looking at a case that took place back in the 90s, and it is super, super strange. It's one that I am very surprised doesn't have that much coverage. There's really barely anything out there, and a lot of the coverage on it is, I'd say, pretty incomplete. It really doesn't tell you the entire story of Michelle's life and everything that she went through.
Yeah, which, to be fair, I think the biggest reason it didn't get like national coverage is because her death was ruled accidental, and it really wasn't looked into beyond that based on the circumstances of where she was found and how she was found, which we'll obviously get into. It involves sharks, a shark attack potentially. Yeah. But also fairly recently, I mean, I guess 2019 is not really that recent, or 2018. And her sister published an article that had a ton of information that was never known prior, mm-hmm. That kind of gives more an inside look into the family and what was going on with Michelle Von Emster, is who we're talking about. Her earlier parts of her life were pretty rough and pretty traumatic. And so it provides a lot more insight into possibly what could have happened to her, because she mysteriously died and she was found floating in the ocean, as we'll get into, and hence why shark attack is brought into this case. But there's just so much uncertainty with the events. There's a time period of a few hours where we don't really know what was going on with her. She was supposed to be at a concert, then all of a sudden she's at Sunset Cliff. I mean, there's just so many different things. Without getting too far into it, that makes this case very mysterious.
Yeah. And it's one that I don't know will ever be solved. I don't know if we will ever have the answer. I mean, a lot of time has passed and there's just so many unusual circumstances here. But I do think it's definitely worth talking about, because Michelle's story alone brings up a lot of important topics that should be discussed.
Very horrific topics.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Definitely want to issue a trigger warning on this one.
So yeah, it's kind of wild, because a lot of the coverage just focuses on the shark attack story theory, and is kind of what I guess has brought that case into today. But Michelle's sister really added so much more context around other theories and other possibilities when it comes to Michelle's death. But yeah, it's a heavy one. So just for a warning, there is a lot of things that some people could find triggering. So just want to put that out there. Before we kind of get into that part of the episode, we'll remind you, in case it's something you don't want to hear, because it is very upsetting. But it's nevertheless an important case for the sake of remembering Michelle and who she was. So shall we dive into it?
Yeah.
Typically, when we start off a case with the background of the victim, this particular case, the details at the time, you know, prior to the article that her sister came out with, we really didn't know a whole lot about Michelle's background, her story, and we didn't know that until far later on. So we're going to take you through the case in more of a chronological, I mean, we're always chronological, but more of a how it's been reported, and it'll make more sense
when
later
the information
on.
Information came out.
Yeah, it'll make a lot more sense later on. So don't, you know, just want to make sure you're not like, oh, this seems like very light on the background information. But there's a lot more to that later on in this episode. So just want to give you a heads up there.
So Michelle Von Emster was born on August 2nd, 1968, to her parents Ernest and Bernadette. She grew up in San Carlos, California, which is a city a little over 20 miles south of San Francisco. She was raised in a strict Roman Catholic home along with four other sisters, Kirsten, Teresa, Marie, and Andrea. Michelle was incredibly close to her sisters, especially Kirsten, who actually was only a year younger than her. And yeah, the two of them were very bonded. Michelle was involved in the church in her youth and was working at the local rectory, which I had never heard of that. We found out that it is a housing unit for the minister, the priest.
Yeah, it's just somewhere for them to live, basically.
So she would work there.
Which
interesting.
Does happen. It's a pretty typical thing. And that extends beyond the Catholic Church as well. I knew some other churches that we went to where that was the case. And I was like, oh, like there's like a little house next door for the pastor and stuff. So it's
not really understand why they need to live there, but what do I know?
Well, they're dedicated to the church for life, you know, like,
yeah, I guess, and that's even more so with Catholicism, right? It's a real,
well, it's commitment. Especially a commitment because priests don't have families,
right?
Right. So they don't need like a whole house with a bunch of bedrooms and stuff. They usually are, I mean, they are single. So,
but as Michelle got older, she began to rebel against her parents. She graduated from Belmont's private all girls Catholic high school, pretty intense. And she left for St. Mary's College of California and would only occasionally visit her parents at that point. Eventually, she moved south to the San Diego coast. And Michelle was very interested in the arts. She had a big passion for music. She liked to follow all of her favorite bands on tour and enjoyed the freedom that she felt living on the Southern California coast. She often switched from job to job, home to home, but those who knew her knew that this was not a problem for her. She was very easygoing, you know, free-spirited. She spent a lot of time in the Ocean Beach area. She was, you know, just kind of living a more relaxed lifestyle and enjoying all the various experiences that life had to offer. And in April of 1994, Michelle was 25 years old and preparing to attend a Pink Floyd concert with her roommate, Coco Campbell. The concert was being held at the Jack Murphy Stadium in San Diego, and the two were thrilled about seeing this obviously iconic band, but they didn't have any tickets to the show. So it isn't known for sure whether or not they were planning to like sneak in, or maybe they were going to try to score tickets outside from a scalper or something like that. We're not really sure, but they weren't able to go in the end. The concert began. They were still outside the venue, ticketless. And at 8 p.m., Coco ended up dropping Michelle off at the beach. Now, she says that Michelle seemed to be in a strange mood and that she said she wasn't ready to go home. So when Coco dropped Michelle off, she was carrying a purse and wearing a green trench coat. And this was the last time Coco would ever see Michelle. The next day, April 15th, 1994, a group of surfers showed up at Sunset Cliffs in San Diego to spend the day surfing, of course. It was a brisk afternoon and the young men were enjoying the waves when 20-year-old David Correa noticed a swarm of seagulls perched on an object floating in a bed of sea kelp at an area called South Garbage. Now, this area got its name because it's a nearby riptide that often spits out random trash into the area. David hollered at a nearby surfer to accompany him to the site, and his name was William Dostal, and he was closer to the area, so he paddled out there first. And as he's approaching, the birds fly away, and he quickly notices that he's looking at the body of a battered and sadly deceased young woman. The body was nude, wearing only a brass bracelet and two rings. She had a butterfly tattoo on her shoulder and long brown hair. William swam back to the shore to tell David what he saw, but as a swell moved into the area, the body was lifted by the swell and flipped over in the water, and David saw the body for himself. And the next hour is a bit of a blur to those on the beach. The first call came into the lifeguard station around 3:18 p.m., and the lifeguards were informed that near Point Loma, there were a couple of surfers who appeared to be holding a lifeless body. Six lifeguards immediately left for the scene, but four of the men were unable to find the location of the body from the beach. Two lifeguards, Bruce Robinson and Joe Wade, had been stationed at the lifeguard dock in Mission Beach. They used a rescue vessel to search for the body from the water, where they did end up finding it around 3:28 p.m. Shortly after, a second rescue vessel arrived to help retrieve the body, and it was transported back to the lifeguard headquarters dock around 4 p.m. Now, since there was massive trauma involved, the medical examiner obviously was immediately notified.
Medical examiner Robert Engel quickly made his way to the lifeguard station, where he noted large tearing-type wounds with missing tissue. Robert stated that the body did not appear to have been in the water for long and marked the cause of death as unknown. But he and the lifeguards all believe that this person was a victim of a shark attack, which, based off of where she's found, the state that her body's in, the state, you know, what the actual injuries look like at first glance, I can definitely see how they're coming to this conclusion. Whether or not that's where you should stop, that's another question. But tearing type wounds, I think, indicates obviously marine life has impacted the state of this body. So I get why they're going this direction. On the following day, April 16, 1994, San Diego medical examiner Brian Blackburn completed an official autopsy. He found that in addition to the missing large pieces of flesh, the woman was missing her right leg from the mid-thigh. Also, her neck was broken, and the examiner said the injury was, quote, as if she'd been in a car wreck. Her face was covered in bruises, scrapes, and contusions. She had broken ribs and a broken pelvis that was, quote, pulled apart. The body's arms and back were described as, quote, shredded. Lastly, the examiner found sand in the body's mouth, throat, lungs, and stomach, as if they had taken a large gasping breath while at the bottom of the ocean floor. Medical examiner Brian Blackburn completed his report and determined, based on the wounds, internal bleeding, and evidence of drowning, that this person did in fact die as a result of an attack by a great white shark. Also, not just saying this was a shark attack, but also claiming it was a great white shark, a specific shark that did this. The same evening as the official autopsy, local news ran a story of an unidentified woman with a butterfly tattoo on her shoulder and long brown hair. In Ocean Beach, a woman named Denise Knox was watching the report with her husband when they heard the news about this woman that they were trying to identify, and she knew she needed to call the police immediately because on Friday, one of Denise's employees didn't show up to her shift at the Cabrillo Stationery and Office Supply Store. And again, the following day, this same employee never showed up. Denise knew that her employee had a butterfly tattoo on her shoulder, so she called the police hoping there was another explanation for why her employee hadn't shown up to work. She was forwarded to the medical examiner's office where she spoke with the coroner. And for half an hour, the woman described her employee in great detail. She told the coroner that her employee was a hippie and that she didn't shave her underarms or her legs. The coroner asked Denise to drive down to the examiner's office as quickly as she could. And just after midnight on Sunday, April 17th, Denise was shown a Polaroid photo of the face of the victim. And sadly, this is when it was confirmed to be 25-year-old Michelle Von Emster.
God, that would be so, so terrifying. And forever, that image would forever stay in your brain. Having to identify someone that you care about.
And kudos to her to even reaching out.
Yeah.
And helping them identify this woman. I mean, because it seems like who knows how long it would have been before the family was notified mm-hmm. or the family got word that Michelle had passed. But according to medical examiner Brian Blackburn, the timeline of events leading to Michelle's death were very simple in his mind. According to him, April 14th at 8 p.m., Michelle's last seen alive. April 15th at 12 a.m., Michelle decided to go skinny dipping in the ocean when she was then attacked by a great white shark. On April 15th at 3:20 p.m., her body is found near the Sunset Cliffs. And that is the end of the timeline, which there's a lot of holes there. After Brian officially reported Michelle's death as accidental, police just moved on from the case. And can't really fault them here because, again, they are going off of the medical examiner, the coroner, what they found. And based on everything that they knew at the time, it seems like this story lines up that maybe she did go take a swim and was attacked by a shark. But it's just hard because, you know, like we heard in last week's episode with the Cherokee Nations authorities, they're like, we assume everything is a murder and we rule that out before we move on to anything else. But again, I think based on the wounds, she'd been in the water, it does make sense to go this direction at first.
I mean, at surface value, it does seem that way. You know, when when I first started looking into this case, my mind was only shark attack. But it's, you know, you don't know the rest of the information. But it so clearly seems that way at first.
True. And as we'll find out, these guys don't really know that much about sharks in the first place, which is pretty important when you're attributing somebody's death to a shark attack.
Right.
So despite Mr. Medical Examiner Brian's confidence in his findings, there is definitely a lot of suspicion almost immediately among those who study shark attacks. Even other medical examiners thought the descriptions of Michelle's injuries didn't quite match up to a great white shark attack. So they're obviously going to be like, okay, it's pretty specific to be that this is a great white shark that did this. And so California has a lot of coastline. There's probably a lot of medical examiners that have experience dealing with great white shark attacks, among other types of shark attacks. And one of the details in Michelle's autopsy was a description of the exposed bone where her leg was missing. And the bone was described as sharp and pointed. And this detail set off alarm bells in the minds of shark attack experts. And as they investigated the case further, they found additional details that really just didn't add up to them. There had been zero evidence of great white shark being within 50 miles of that location at the time of Shell's supposed attack. I don't know exactly what the tracking systems were like at this time, but I know I in the past have had the app that tracks the great white sharks. A lot of them are tagged and monitored and studied by scientists. And so I don't know exactly how they came to this conclusion, but it was something that they brought up. And they also said that the wounds didn't seem typical to those who studied these types of attacks. But Brian, he's like, okay, you guys are questioning me, but no. I'm the one who saw the body. I'm the one who did the autopsy. These are my findings. And he even said that he reached out to the marine biologists at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego, a major institution in marine biology and research. And they even agreed that a great white shark had likely attacked Michelle. So we think. At one point, Brian stated, quote, "If it wasn't a white shark, then what was it?" Which inspires a ton of confidence in the citizens, I'm sure, to hear their medical examiner say this.
So those who study shark attacks know that there are very clear signs that indicate a shark attack and the type of shark attack. For a great white, there are a few things to note. Great whites usually attack their prey by giving a sudden ram at a high speed, which is terrifying to think about. These sharks can travel up to 35 miles per hour in short bursts, which absolutely blew my mind.
Yeah, and they also tend to attack from beneath, like deep below you, which always has terrified me.
Oof.
You know, they'll kind of swim around. They'll come like check out what's going on, and then they'll just go down real deep where you won't see them anymore, and then they'll just like a torpedo. Swim 30 miles per hour and then leap out of the water while also ramming into or taking a bite out of whatever. Or if you ever seen, I mean, Shark Week, love that show. There's a lot of great footage of shark or great white sharks and how they interact and even ramming cages. There's one great clip of a guy got in a plexiglass cage with a bunch of great whites. It literally, they crushed the plexiglass. The guy had to like quickly swim out of the water.
Oh, you showed me this.
Yeah. It's a crazy,
dude,
crazy clip.
Never.
Yeah.
That's so terrifying. I mean, I've seen plenty of videos of them fucking up seals, and that is scary alone to watch. I mean, the force, they do come out of nowhere like that. Anyway, we're getting off track, but they do also bite the side of their prey before pulling back and removing a chunk of flesh. And great whites are notorious for leaving behind teeth in the victim's wounds. But Michelle didn't have any of these signs. There were no teeth in her body, and there were no large bites taken from her side. So it really doesn't look like an attack from a great white. Brian argued that the shark didn't get a hold of her side, but that it obviously had grabbed a hold of Michelle's leg, hence why there was such a large portion of her leg missing. However, other experts still didn't buy this. As we said, Michelle's leg bone was described as being broken to a point. And a shark expert named Ralph Collier described it as looking like a piece of bamboo that was kind of like whittled down to a point, like if you were to, you know, go at it with a knife.
Yeah.
And the only shark in those waters who could sever a leg is the great white shark. However, it's estimated that these sharks have a bite force of 18,000 newtons or 4,000 pounds of force. And when they bite through limbs of humans, they create a break that is straight across, not angular.
Indicating that the way that the bone appears does not line up with a great white biting off the leg at that point. That's something else happened there.
Yeah, it's just not possible.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking up great white statistics because I'm like, these animals are just unbelievable. But they actually don't have the strongest bite in the world. They have the third strongest bite. Well, they're estimated to. American alligators are second, and saltwater crocodiles are the first.
That was surprising to me.
Me too.
I would have thought great whites would be above both of them. But as shark expert Ralph explained it, quote, "When a white shark bites off part of a limb, the break is clean, almost like you put it on a table saw. What remained of Michelle's femur was anything but." He also noted that the other bites on Michelle's body couldn't have been made by a great white shark as they were too small and also incorrectly shaped. These bites were most likely created by smaller sharks. These smaller sharks wouldn't have been able to kill Michelle or drag her down to the bottom of the ocean, but they would have been able to take the opportunity, obviously, to feed on a dead body that they found floating in the water. And Ralph also pointed out that if a great white shark had grabbed Michelle by the leg, bit her, and severed her leg, she would have bled out almost immediately. She certainly would have been dead before even having the opportunity to breathe sand into her lungs. Therefore, it's more likely that the bone was broken before she died. She drowned, and then the other animals picked away at her broken leg until part of it was removed. Now, those who were skeptical of Brian's findings were also quick to point out that Brian had never worked on a victim who had been attacked by a shark before, ever. In fact, he had admitted that he had never so much as seen a shark bite victim before. Additionally, the experts at Scripps Institute didn't look at the body. Instead, they gave advice based on the descriptions made verbally by Brian. And the Scripps Institute expert that Brian consulted was Chairman Richard Rosenblatt. And when he was later shown the measurements and images of Michelle's wounds, he said that, quote, none of the marks on Michelle's body were caused by a white shark. And another point of contention comes from the examination's witness. Brian claimed that the autopsy of Michelle was witnessed by Dr. Harry Bonnell, but in an interview with the San Diego Reader, Dr. Bonnell claimed that he wasn't there. He, quote, says, I didn't witness the autopsy, even though Blackburn says I did. I'm sure I would remember a shark attack like this one, but I wasn't there. So why he just made up the fact that someone else witnessed this and gave a specific name,
right?
Totally bizarre. And why? I don't understand.
My guess is that, you know, he doesn't want to admit that potentially he was wrong. I think that's kind of embarrassing on his part. And so he probably just made that up to try and, you know, back up whatever statement he was previously saying. And I mean, yeah, I think it's stupid.
Yeah, it's just so dumb to say something that's so easy to prove to be a lie.
Yeah.
It's just odd.
Are we surprised, though?
No.
This kind of stuff happens all the time, though, unfortunately.
Yeah. We see so much bullshit with medical examiners. Yeah.
Is it weird? Sure. Could it have something to do with how this all turns out? Maybe. But I think it's just this kind of stuff happens with medical examiners, unfortunately,
yeah,
across the country. But I've just been kind of looking at some different things because I'm curious. With great white sharks in San Diego, the last death to occur as a result of a great white shark was in 2008. A swimmer in the early morning, which I believe they say sharks feed in the morning and at dusk. Like,
yes,
dawn and dusk is when they feed. So Michelle is out in the ocean potentially at midnight, which obviously doesn't mean that sharks aren't feeding at that time. But I believe they're like most active at dawn and dusk because mm-hmm. the visibility, there's like some visibility there. It's just a part of their instinctual hunting characteristics. But so David Martin was a 66-year-old retired veterinarian who was swimming with a group around 14 miles north San Diego. He was attacked by a great white shark. And it was, again, like a sneak attack. And this thing actually like popped him out of the water. Like he was swimming and it rammed him out of the water and then it dragged him down.
Ugh,
and
nightmare.
Definitely took a few bites out of him.
He survived?
No, he died.
Oh.
He succumbed to his wounds. They were able to pull him out of the water, which was good. But obviously a bite from a great white is going to be devastating. But teeth were removed. Yeah. So the teeth thing is very key for a great white shark. Almost another one in Maine fairly recently. That victim also had fragments of teeth in their body as well. So the shark thing definitely is possible. Is it possible that she was already dead before entering the ocean though? And, you know, a bunch of sharks fed on her body at that point. That's a big question. And I think one that is definitely worth thinking about. But let's continue here because we'll get into that here in a little bit. These days we're all busy and it seems like we just never have enough time in the day to do all the things we need to do. But one thing that you need to make time for, and it's super important for your life, your future, and honestly, everything else, is your personal finances. And I have become such a fan and absolutely use this app every single day. And that app is Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. You can literally rocket your money to the next level if you use this app. I've been using it for, I think, the past year. It is free to try and you get some of the features, but I pay for the actual app itself because it's really not that expensive. And honestly, Rocket Money has saved me hundreds of dollars since I've started using it. But I absolutely love how I have full control over all my finances from one dashboard on my phone. It's just so easy to use. And the ability to go and organize all of your subscriptions in one place, it does it for you, which is amazing. Because really, bank accounts and like even these modern websites and dashboards that they offer don't organize the expenses for you in a way that is actually helpful. When you look at your statements, it's just this long list of transactions. Rocket Money allows you to sync up all your accounts, credit cards, and it does all of the sorting for you. And then what I love most about it is that if I find a subscription that I don't want to pay for anymore, Rocket Money is able to go and take care of that for me. I don't have to reach out to customer service. It's just tap of a button and Rocket Money does the rest. You can monitor your spending by setting up alerts for different transactions or companies so that if an amount goes over maybe what you typically pay for that bill or credit card payment, you get notified via email, which is awesome. I can also monitor my credit score. It just is a great place to do everything all in one place. They'll even try to negotiate a lower bill for you by up to 20%. You just take a picture of the bill. Rocket Money does the rest. So Rocket Money has over 5 million users, including me, and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/milehigher. That's rocketmoney.com/milehigher. Go to rocketmoney.com/milehigher to let them know we sent you. The detail that a shark killed Michelle isn't the only part of Brian's whole death timeline that people really didn't feel like it added up. Brian and the police believe that Michelle had willingly gone skinny dipping around midnight. However, the waters on that night were pretty cold, around 59 degrees, and skinny dipping could have easily caused hypothermia, but hypothermia is not mentioned anywhere in the coroner's report. So that is very interesting to note, because if she did go skinny dipping, the water was cold enough that it likely would have caused hypothermia, so there would have been evidence to back that up, because it makes sense. You go skinny dipping in cold water, you get hypothermia, you die in one piece, and then you're floating out there, and you get eaten at that point. But I don't know. The fact that that's not mentioned there, is that just a mistake? Was that just left out? Or did they actually not find any evidence of hypothermia? I don't know if we'll ever know. But Brian's final report mentioned that Michelle's purse had been located 2 miles down the beach from where her body was found. In his theory, Michelle left her purse and then entered the water at the same location. So she went off the beach, goes swimming, gets attacked by a shark, and then she floats 2 miles away from the beach area. And that's where she's eventually found around 3 p.m. on the 15th. However, experts conducted a drift test to see how long it would have taken Michelle's body to make its way from where she supposedly entered the water to where she was actually found. And their results show that it would have taken the body a minimum of 15 hours to make the journey. Brian used these numbers to determine that Michelle had entered the water around midnight. However, others who saw these results couldn't help but remember that a witness saw Michelle at 8 p.m. And it's very curious to me why more wasn't done to determine what happened between 8 p.m. and midnight to Michelle.
Yeah, it's a large period of time there.
It seems like a sizable amount that should at least be looked into to see if there's anything weird that happened potentially during that 4 hour period. To just be like, oh, who knows what she was doing for 4 hours
out in the cold,
and then she enters the water at 12 o'clock. I mean, that's a lot of time to be out there. I mean, maybe she was, but still worth looking into, I think. But regardless of the holes in the report, Michelle's case was closed. And I believe to this day is still closed. And for all intents and purposes, she was a shark bite victim who died a tragic and accidental death. But still, people couldn't help but produce new theories on what might have happened to Michelle. So one of the most prominent theories about Michelle's death involves the Sunset Cliffs near where her body was found. This area is absolutely stunning. I've never been there. Actually, I was in San Diego as a kid, like a toddler. So I don't think my parents were taking me to Sunset Cliffs. I was at the zoo. But it does look beautiful on Google. You guys were just in San Diego. Did you see Sunset Cliffs?
We did not. But
what?
The whole area of San Diego is so beautiful.
Bachelorette party.
Well, didn't you guys want to see the sunset? No,
we were too busy. We were at the clubs.
Yeah. We're getting sunset.
The most scenic place in San Diego, the nightclubs.
Yeah. We actually had the whole club to ourselves. It's a story for another day.
It's a real hopping town. Mm-hmm. Or you guys were in Oceanside, right?
Yeah. Well, we went to San Diego for the night. But yeah, I mean, that whole area is so beautiful.
It is.
God, I'm jealous of people who live in San Diego. We have family, yeah. Kendall and I do, in San Diego. And
we've been gorgeous. Several times in our lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, just looking at Google, there's houses right across the street from the Sunset mm-hmm. Cliffs.
Yeah.
So there's people who walk out their front door and literally be at the cliffs.
Yep, man, that's the life.
That is the life. It's beautiful. But these cliffs are very, very steep, very rocky. As beautiful as they are, insanely dangerous. If you ever visit, you'll see signs warning sightseers of the unstable nature of the cliff, because it turns out these cliffs are made of sandstone, a substance that is known for crumbling at the slightest bit of pressure. In fact, one study done on data from 2005 to 2018 showed that there were 5 deaths or significant injuries a year at the San Diego Sandstone Cliffs. And I wanted to know when the last time someone died at the Sandstone Cliffs, and it was 2022.
Yeah.
Kind of a similar situation. I don't think it was from falling off the cliffs. I think they drowned at the bottom base of the cliffs, but they were found right where Michelle was found, pretty much. But this whole area, I mean, and whenever you have steep cliffs like that, the ocean's going to be pretty, pretty violent coming up to that rocky area. And the beach even looks rocky too. I think there may be some sand, but it's primarily a rocky area here. Critics of the theory pointed out that if Michelle had been hanging out in the cliffs that night, it's unlikely that she would have left her purse 2 miles away on the beach. The whole thing with where her purse is found and why it wasn't found earlier is kind of weird too.
Mm-hmm.
But another theory about Michelle's death involves an accidental overdose. The thought is that Michelle may have succumbed to her drug use or had an accident while with her friends and in a panic. And not wanting to get caught by the police, the friends take it upon themselves to go and throw Michelle's body off the cliffs and into the water to try to like cover it up. Very out there theory.
Possible, very unlikely.
Doesn't make any logical sense whatsoever.
No.
And then obviously once in the water, sea life consume parts of the body. Again, lots of issues with that. Don't really hold a lot of credence to that one whatsoever. This next theory as well, Michelle may have been in a car accident, because again, go back to the neck injury. He specified that it was similar to what neck injuries look like when people are in car accidents. I guess that's where people are getting this theory, but there's no evidence to suggest that she was ever in a car after she was dropped off at the cliffs.
No, it's honestly such a stupid theory.
Like, why? Where did that even come from? And what was she was hurt in the car accident and then like wandered off the cliff. How'd she get in the water? And where's the car?
We know that there were no car accidents in that area around this time. So it just, that one's a big nope.
But the theory that I think is worth looking into, at least, and definitely has a little bit more evidence, is maybe this wasn't accidental. Maybe this wasn't, you know, a shark attack. Maybe this was murder, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Initially, the most popular theory out there was that Michelle was a victim of a murder. Michelle had been having issues in the weeks leading up to her death. She had told her friends about a possible stalker that she had, and mentioned being uncomfortable with the attention of a particular customer at one of her former jobs. And at the time that she died, Michelle was also living in an area of Ocean Beach that was nicknamed the War Zone due to its level of violence and drug crimes. And this has led many to believe that this stalker or another sketchy person in the area possibly attacked Michelle while she was on the beach and then drowned her in shallow waters and tossed her body from Sunset Cliffs. People also point out that the purse that Michelle left behind was on the heavily populated part of the beach and in an area where bag thefts were common. So how is it possible that her purse and its belongings managed to spend almost 24 hours on the beach without being noticed or taken? Which, yes, it is unlikely, but it's possible that no one picked it up, or people did pick it up, looked inside, and there wasn't anything valuable enough to them to take, or that no one saw it. So I don't necessarily think that's a huge element of evidence, Anyway, when the police found the bag hours after finding Michelle, it still contained keys, cigarettes, and some cash. One theory is that Michelle's murderer planted the bag on the beach after she was found to help pivot the police away from where she was actually murdered. If she was attacked and potentially sexually assaulted, this would explain why Michelle was naked at the time of her death. An anonymous lifeguard did come forward claiming that he had previously seen Michelle swimming topless in the ocean. However, that was during warmer weather and during the daytime, which is quite different than swimming completely nude in frigid waters past midnight. And just to clarify, that is just coming from this lifeguard. We don't even know if that's true. However, another person did come forward and claimed that they knew that Michelle swam naked. This was a man named Edwin Decker. Now, this guy is pretty
creepy.
Stuff. Yeah, I'd say creepy. What a
creepy dude.
Mm-hmm. Edwin was a co-worker of Michelle's. And at the time that she died, he made statements that Michelle was a hippie and that she had told him that she often surfed naked. However, Michelle's closest friends said not only had they never seen her surfing before, but they definitely never heard her mention surfing in the nude. And people started to wonder if Edwin was simply trying to give information that would explain away some of the strange details of her death so that investigators wouldn't look any further into the details. Edwin also made claims that the night before Michelle died on the 13th of April, that the two of them sat down for a few drinks together. Afterward, he said that he and Michelle made out before she left his place around 5 a.m. on the 14th of April. Edwin also said that the two of them had been flirting with each other for weeks. He said they, quote, had a total intellectual connection and felt there was an emotional connection, too. He went on to add to that at least on my part, there was. So I think that tells you quite a bit right there. And when Michelle hadn't contacted Edwin afterward, he said he was, quote, so bummed when a couple of days went by and she hadn't called. The interesting thing is there are no reports from Michelle's friends or coworkers describing any type of relationship between Michelle and Edwin, not even a casual flirting relationship. So many people found Edwin's statements to be pretty odd. Like, he was adding details that would make others think that what he and Michelle had was, you know, a lot deeper of a romance than they genuinely did. Now, one of the weirdest things that Edwin did after he found out about Michelle's death was that he wrote and published one of the most bizarre and disturbing poems of all time. It says, "The report said there was a tattoo, a butterfly on her shoulder, which I remembered that night on my couch when I, like the shark, chewed on her lips and took off her shirt."
That truly is like one of the creepiest things I've ever.
It's so fucking weird and insensitive, and
it gives me stalker vibes.
Yeah. It's just so odd. I mean, to play devil's advocate here, I know poetry is an art form. Maybe he's grieving and this is his weird way of processing it. I'm just playing devil's advocate because
making a poem maybe, but specifically saying on my couch when I, like the shark, chewed on her lips and took off her shirt.
No, I know. You're right. It's weird. I shouldn't even try to justify Edwin. It's fucking weird, Edwin. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, and to also go back to his quote, I felt there was an emotional connection too. Yeah. At least on my part, there was.
Yeah.
I get feelings of SA going on here. That there's potentially some.
We have no evidence.
I'm just saying, to be clear. Maybe, possibly, something's going on here that doesn't feel right to me.
It's definitely creepy, bizarre behavior. There is no evidence of anything further. Not to defend Edwin any further.
But there could be no evidence because he was never investigated as a suspect because this was never investigated as a homicide.
That's a good point.
So
it's strange behavior that should have been looked into further, for sure.
Seems like at least, again, consider all possibilities before just ruling on what seems the most obvious theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because sometimes they get things wrong.
Yeah. And if you look at the poem from that lens too, is it possible that he's trying to further solidify the idea that it was a shark attack?
Right.
You know?
could Edwin have also planted the info with the lifeguards that she swam naked, that she was topless, mm-hmm. to try to create this narrative that, oh no, she was, you know, naked all the time. That's just what she did. I don't know. Possibility.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. Scary.
And if she's complaining about somebody potentially stalking her, and he's literally with her the day before this all happens.
Yeah, I know.
It's all very, very strange.
It is.
And in my opinion, should have been looked into further, because there's clearly, whether or not he's involved in her death, there could be other things going on there that may have led her to her death. Mm-hmm. Whether they did it or she did it to herself, maybe there was something that was like the final straw, that breaking point that happened with Edwin that leads us to other theories, mm-hmm. is what I'm saying. So
yeah, I mean, it's definitely possible. I just want to clarify. I'm not trying to like defend Edwin. I'm just, there is no concrete evidence to show that he was involved in her death. And it is possible that he was someone who cared about Michelle, truly felt the loss of her death, and he has...
he has a mental illness or something. A very strange
way of coping with it.
Sure.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say mental illness, but...
I don't
know. People cope with things in very, very bizarre ways that can't always be understood by others.
Okay.
That's true.
Sure.
I still think it's bizarre and should have been looked into further. I just wanted to be clear that we are not...
yeah, I got you.
...framing him.
No, I got you. We're not framing him. There is no evidence.
Yeah.
Because it was never investigated.
You just got to be careful.
Yeah. And again, he does try to team up with an investigator to request that the medical examiners reevaluate Michelle's death, which could take it either way, because it could just be further another way for him to try to make it seem like he's innocent.
Yeah. But it also...
But on the flip side, he could absolutely be... he just like maybe cared a lot about her. Maybe she didn't feel that way back, but he feels like some type of connection with her and feels bad, or, you know, just wants to help.
Or yeah, he is really trying to insert himself into it. I mean, we have seen that in the past where people who are involved try to look like they are the ones that are helping to.
Right. You know, especially when you look at murders involving stalkers.
Yep.
That kind of stuff happens a lot. They want to be involved. They insert themselves into the investigation. And I don't know. I don't know. I'm very suspicious of Edwin, if you can't tell.
Yeah. I think we all are suspicious of Edwin.
But also, there's more to come that also gives you a whole other look into to Michelle's past and another theory that I think holds a lot of credence as well. So let's continue.
So I am wearing a fantastic outfit today. First thing when I walked in the building, Janelle told me that I looked... Gen Z.
You really did.
Thank you. I am Gen Z.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
Wrong.
You're a millennial mother.
If you wear Gen Z clothes, you are Gen Z. That's how it works. Well, thanks to Stitch Fix, this outfit came together, actually. They keep me looking Gen Z. Stitch Fix sends style so good, you can feel it. They deliver all the confidence that comes from a truly amazing outfit without any of the work. With Stitch Fix, you get a stylist who understands your style, your size, your budget, and they do all the shopping for you. Because, as I've said many times, I hate shopping. There is nothing less that I would rather do than go to the mall and go in dressing rooms. Just, I hate all of it. So Stitch Fix just makes my life so much easier. I've been using Stitch Fix for far longer than they've been sponsoring our shows. I pay for it myself every month, and I truly love it. My stylist helps me take my wardrobe to the next level. She knows what works for me, sometimes even better than I do myself. She helps me discover new things about my style. It's like my stylish best friend is doing the shopping for me. All you gotta do is give your stylist your size, your style, your budget preferences, and I order boxes that I want and how I want. There's no subscription required, so I can just skip one if I need it or get more when I want. And then they send 5 just for me pieces, plus outfit recommendations and pro styling tips. I keep what I love and I send back the rest, and it could not be easier because they send you a prepaid shipping bag. You just throw everything in there, stick it in the mailbox, and you're good to go. Style that makes you feel as good as you look. Get started today at stitchfix.com/milehigher. That's stitchfix.com/milehigher. stitchfix.com/milehigher. So any information that they discovered in their investigation was not released to the public, and Michelle's death remains documented as an accidental drowning and shark attack. However, throughout the years, people have speculated about what truly happened to Michelle. One person who is particularly invested in Michelle's death is a man who hosts a shark attack podcast called The Shark Files. And in 2021, the show had its second ever episode titled Sunset Cliffs. The episode did a deep dive into Michelle's case, and 8 months after it was released, Shark Files blog posted an update on the case, and they said they believed they discovered the cause of Michelle's death, a tragic suicide. Now, to prove this, the podcast references an article on Medium.com.
And before I go any further, again, just a forewarning, we're about to talk about a lot of very disturbing things involving sexual assault on children, even pertaining to the Catholic Church. So proceed with caution. On February 4th, 2019, Michelle's younger sister, Teresa, published an article that was posted to the website Medium. The article is titled, "The Roman Catholic Church Raped My Family and It Wasn't an Accident." That right there is just horrifying to even think that that would be the title of the article. In the article, Teresa begins by discussing a grand jury report that came out in August 2018 regarding the sexual abuse of 1,000 children by at least 300 Catholic priests. When the report was publicized, some people were shocked and disgusted by the news, while others were relieved that finally this huge issue is finally being discussed. Teresa then went on to state that her family had allegedly been directly impacted by the perversions of a Catholic priest by the name Father Greg Engels. According to Teresa, Father Engels had been moved from parish to parish, school to school, and each and every time he was called out for his pedophilic abusive behavior. However, Michelle's family had no idea that any of this was going on at the time when they met him at St. Charles Rectory in 1982. The rectory functioned as an office for the local parish and contained a K-8 school. The congregation was huge, and Father Engels was only one of multiple priests holding residency at the church. That same year, Michelle and her sister Kirsten began working at the church rectory. They, along with another teenager who is referred to as Anna in the article, worked directly with the priest to complete tasks around the rectory as needed. Father Engels seemed charming to the girls and their families, and they were unaware that he had been accused of violent sexual crimes against at least one male and one female student from another church. They were also unaware that he had spent noticeably short periods of time at a multitude of churches, which is consistent with the behavior surrounding other sexually offending priests in the Catholic Church. Each time Father Engels was called out for his behavior, his higher-ups simply moved him somewhere new and allowed him to pray on a new group of potential victims. Almost immediately after starting work with Father Engels, the three girls all became very uncomfortable with him, and Father Engels started grooming them. He would linger a little too long when touching the girls. He'd offer back rubs, massages, and long hugs, all very concerning. Disgusting. And inappropriate. After a few months, Father Engels took things further with Michelle when she was just 14 years old. Reportedly, he forced a kiss on her, and Michelle would later tell her friends that she had to physically fight him off of her to make him stop. Absolutely disgusting. But the abuse did not end there. On another occasion, the priest allegedly showed up at Michelle's house when she was the only one at home and sexually abused her. The attack was so traumatic that Michelle would later tell her boyfriend Eric that at one point she blacked out, and when she woke up, it was over.
God, that is so terrifying and beyond upsetting.
After this heinous attack, Father Engels left the home, cleaned up, and returned a few hours later to eat dinner alongside Michelle and her family. I mean, the nerve of this guy. I mean, just, ah.
Well, that's how they work.
It's demonic.
Make it all seem normal.
Right. Nothing happened.
Yep.
In the report, Teresa described that this was the beginning of the end for Michelle. According to Teresa, Michelle tried to explain to her parents what had happened to her, but they simply could not understand the extent of the abuse that went on. Maybe Michelle's too afraid to go into detail, or perhaps the parents simply thought she was exaggerating the things that had happened to her. However, after Michelle's sister Kirsten and Anna from the church came forward to say that Father Engels had made them all feel uncomfortable, her parents finally confronted the church. However, Father Engels used his charisma and reputation to talk the parents down. He told them that perhaps Michelle had misread his intentions.
Okay.
What other intentions are there? I mean, it's...
Yep, just blame the victim.
A child.
Right. Yep. A 14-year-old girl. Maybe perhaps he had just let them get too close to him sometimes and should have known better. He even told them that Michelle would often ask to sit on his lap. And he learned that he should not have allowed that.
Bullshit.
Okay, dude. You
she did not that. Ask to sit yeah. on your lap.
A 14-year-old? What?
Dude, what an idiot to even try and say that.
And what's even sadder is that Michelle's parents believed him. And she was forced to continue working at the church with her sister and friend. Forced to face her abuser repeatedly. Forced to suffer from his disgusting and horrific actions. Teresa described how Michelle started dating a boy named Bob in high school, and Father Ingalls would try to break them up. He would tell Michelle and her parents that Bob was no good for her. He would stare Bob down when he had come to the church or rectory, and overall, Father Ingalls was extremely possessive of Michelle. Teresa and her family would like to believe that Father Ingalls only raped Michelle once, but there's truly no way of knowing how many times he may have harmed her. Regardless of the number of assaults, Michelle began to act out at home and pick fights with her parents, which is a common behavior of children who have suffered a sexual assault. Around the same time, her boyfriend Bob would sometimes bring Michelle home from dates early and tell her parents that Michelle had fainted. Afterward, Michelle began having fainting spells at school, and Michelle's mother took her to multiple doctors, but nobody gave her any clues as to what was happening to her daughter. Now, I think it's important to note that in this article, Teresa provided some more context as to why her parents reacted the way that they did. Because I think it's easy to get angry at them and blame them for this happening to Michelle. But she goes on to explain that while Catholics are encouraged to question their faith, they are not encouraged to question the institution. She continues by stating, quote, "My parents, for whom the church is the bedrock and foundation of their identity and lifestyle, followed accepted Catholic principles when it came to this new allegation. They even took it to the parish priest, Father John Ryan. With his aid and the aid of a former San Francisco district attorney, everyone worked together to resolve the situation within the church. Ostensibly, this was a way to preserve her family's privacy. No one suggested at any time that this was a criminal matter that rightfully should have been reported to the police, including the district attorney friend." So we have somebody who was a district attorney being a part of this conversation, at least, doesn't think it needs to go to the authorities. What?
Yeah.
That's shocking. The San Jose Diocese, which was led by Bishop Patrick McGraw, was in charge of the investigation. The diocese only interviewed two people, her high school boyfriend Bob and Eric, her other boyfriend. The diocese never attempted to speak with others who were working at the rectory at the time or reach out to other victims. Teresa also claims that the diocese never interviewed Kirsten or Anna, even though her parents suggested that they do. According to Teresa, after the diocese spoke with Bob and Eric, Father Ingalls underwent a psychiatric evaluation, and it was determined that he did not fit the profile of a pedophile. So the church closed the investigation due to having, quote, insufficient grounds. And who even knows, I mean, what that psychiatric evaluation, I mean, that's such what even that entailed.
Right.
As a disgusting side note, Father Ingalls was eventually promoted to a canon lawyer, whose job it is to make sure that the rules of the church order are properly understood and applied. And he apparently even continued to work as a specialist in sexual abuse investigations involving priests and church prosecution.
How does that happen?
Even despite these allegations, they're like, well, insufficient ground, so let's promote the guy.
Yeah, and let's make him
head.
Yep.
And the leading expert in handling accusations of sexual assault and abuse within the Roman Catholic Church.
It's terrifying.
It's sick, is what it is. It's demented. In 1996, new allegations against Father Ingalls were brought to the diocese, and eventually in 2003, he was arrested and charged. Sadly, but not really all that surprisingly, the church claimed that 1996 was the first time the church had heard about Father Ingalls' crimes.
Convenient.
Yeah. Mind you, this is 2 years after Michelle's parents had told the church about Michelle's abuse.
And chances are other people told them about their experiences as well, and they're like, eh.
Well, we all know the truth about this, that the Catholic Church has swept this abuse under the rug for years and years and years, and maybe still do.
Oh, for sure still do. Of course they do.
It's very sad and very disturbing that this is going on. And again, to be fair, this is not just the Catholic Church. This is across all religions, all denominations, in one way or another.
But it is very prominent in the Catholic Church, specifically.
Specifically with priests.
Yep.
Even with these public accusations, the church assigned Father Ingalls to serve as fill-in priest at another parish that had an on-site school. That is terrifying.
Yep.
He continues to be able to be around young children, young girls, promoted. Unbelievable. And guess what? All of these charges ended up being dropped because the statute of limitations had expired. Father Engels continued to serve in a legal role for the church until another accusation came in 2015. And at that point, he was ultimately laicized, which basically means kicked out. And that is a long time that this guy operated. Who knows how many victims he had.
Mm-hmm. Or still probably has. I don't know. Is he still alive?
Last I knew in Teresa's article, it seemed as though he was. Now, again, this was in 2019, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, so he may not be harming people within the church, but who knows what else he's doing out in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
True.
If he's alive.
Also, side note, in 1996, California passed a law that made priests mandated reporters of abuse. And this essentially means that they are obligated by law to report to CPS if they are aware of or suspect child abuse. However, the church didn't bother to educate priests on this law until 2002. 6 years after the law was passed.
6 years.
Yeah, convenient. Additionally, this is sick. Between the years of 2002 and 2014, the Vatican reported that 3,420 priests were tried globally. However, only 848 were found guilty and laicized. Less than 25% of them.
That's some bullshit.
Were found guilty.
Yeah. Such a small percentage.
It's absolutely alarming. And I wanted to talk, because this is like one of the big questions I think a lot of people have. And we were talking about this before, is if this is going on, you know, like if somebody comes to a priest and says, hey, you know, I committed a crime, or, you know, report child sexual abuse to somebody within the church, maybe it was one of the other priests and they're complaining about a different priest there that they alleged did something to them or to a family member, is that priest responsible for reporting that to the authorities so that a proper investigation and justice can be served? And I've heard a lot of different things over the years, just covering cases involving priests. But I think it goes back to the seal of confession and priest penitent privilege. So the code of canon law forbids priests from divulging information received in confession. The penalty for a priest who directly violates the seal of confession is excommunication. So this is a protected thing. There are some states, I think California is one of them, that have made that a little bit more difficult, specifically pertaining to protecting children and young people. This is the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. It's a comprehensive set of procedures originally established by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And this was created or established in June 2002 for addressing allegations of sexual abuse of minors by Catholic clergy. So this charter includes guidelines for reconciliation, healing, accountability, and prevention of future acts of abuse. And it does say within the charter that creating a safe environment for children and young people, healing and reconciliation of victims and survivors, cooperating with civil authorities. But basically, my point is that the way that they view it is that, no, they do not need to bring, they, like, if you go commit a crime to a priest, that doesn't mean the priest is then going to go call the police on you.
You admit to
What they will do is encourage you to go turn yourself in. Like, in order to get right, like, if you're there to get right with God, one of the things they're going to tell you is, well, you need to confess your sins, not only to me, but you need to, you know, turn yourself into the authorities. But there is this protection in place that they do not have to report you to, like, they're not going to call 911 once they get done with you and be like, hey, so-and-so just confessed to me.
But I think that must vary on the law, because mandated reporters, it's not like, oh yeah, teachers, therapists, doctors, whatever, are mandated reporters. And yeah, priests are too now, apparently, except for if they confess in the confessional or whatever it's called. Like,
yeah. Oh, that's the cone of silence room.
But by law, you have to.
Yeah.
I mean, at least in California, I mean, unless this law changed.
Are we surprised that a system that is set up to protect predators is rampant with predators?
No. Mm-hmm.
It's just like...
So the thing with this is that this clergy penitent privilege is the recognition of the proper relation between church and state and the constitutionally protected right to free exercise of religion. The government has no right to encroach upon the sacred communication. As Catholics, we advocate for this protection not only for ourselves, but for people of all faiths. So there, and there's multiple examples of like how this has made it into the courts, and ultimately the courts recognize this constitutional right, I guess.
I'm sorry, but that is a load of crap, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So basically they're saying the reason why they have this is because it would defeat the whole purpose of confession. People wouldn't come and confess to them if they knew that they were going to be reported to the authorities. So therefore it infringes on their right to exercise freedom of religion. And it would basically break the whole seal of confession. So therefore this has to be a protected thing for them and is in many states. I think some states have done different things to try and kind of break this down a little bit for specific examples, but it seems like at least the view of the Catholic Church is that this is a sacred right that should not be touched by any state, local, federal law because it's constitutionally protected.
Okay. Very convenient.
But it's like, is it worth it to have that?
No, of course
not. When so much horrific abuse is going on? I don't know. I'm curious. Again, I'm not a Catholic. I have family that are Catholic, and maybe I'll ask them about the seal of confession at our Easter lunch.
That's a great time to bring it up. I dare you.
Oh my God.
Oh, I would love to see that.
I want to ask one of my aunts, see what they say. I'm curious. So yeah, I really don't know anything. I'm just reading off of, if I got anything wrong, I apologize. And I'd be interested if any of you know more about this or have personal experience with this, please let us know in the comments or on social media, because I'm very curious about this.
Mm-hmm. But let's get back to Michelle's case. We're getting pretty distracted here. Although this all does tie very much into Michelle's story. But despite Michelle's struggle, she did graduate high school in 1984 and enrolled in St. Mary's College in Moraga, California. And over the next 2 years, Michelle's life took a distinct turn. She fell into a bad crowd. She began drinking heavily and was thought to be using marijuana and cocaine. And after 2 years, she did drop out of St. Mary's and enrolled in beauty college. Her family hoped that a change of scenery might help her, but her addiction to alcohol did continue. And then shortly after she began her studies, Michelle was diagnosed with leukemia. So for months, Michelle's mother took her back and forth to appointments and stayed by her side as she fought against cancer. And after a year, Michelle was in complete remission from her cancer, and it seemed like her life was finally going to get back on track. She rented a house in Loma Portal, which is an idyllic place that overlooks the San Diego Bay. But after a short time in Loma Portal, Michelle moved to Ocean Beach, where the crime rates were high. And sadly, Michelle's trauma caught up to her, and she did fall back into that spiral of addiction. And Michelle didn't feel comfortable at home anymore, or perhaps she didn't feel safe. So she picked back up on her, quote, hippie ways, as her sister describes them, and began following the band The Grateful Dead on tour. And according to Teresa, she, quote, only showed up at the family home when the Dead were in town. And she was doing drugs again, specifically marijuana and heroin. And her parents decided to give Michelle some tough love. They told her that she either needed to get off the drugs or stay away. So Michelle chose to stay away. And keep in mind, this was during Nancy Reagan's Just Say No movement.
Oh, this was right in the middle of the war on drugs.
Yep. And this was very prevalent at the time. People did not really have, you know, any understanding of drug addiction. They didn't get that it's an illness, that it's much more complicated than just saying no, you know, just stop. There just was not, I mean, to this day, there's still not enough understanding of that. But especially back then, it was really rough.
Well, we have a whole episode on it, too.
Yeah, we do.
We go into great detail about the war on drugs and a lot of the bad that came out of that.
So over the next 4 years, Michelle worked multiple jobs to fund her life and her addiction, and she began hanging out with sort of a rough crowd. One of Michelle's jobs was at a coffee shop, and according to multiple reports, Michelle left that job because there was a customer who frequently made her feel uncomfortable. She told her friends that he practically stalked her, And it appears she never identified this man, but she did tell her friends that he drove a motorcycle. Teresa claims that she left her coffee shop job for a far worse reason than a creepy customer. According to Teresa, and this is crazy, the coffee shop was robbed and Michelle was held at gunpoint. So God, what a traumatic life Michelle truly had. Teresa believes that Michelle may have been sexually assaulted during that event, which obviously we don't know if that's true. Nobody will ever honestly know if that actually happened or why Michelle left her job or many of the other decisions that she made in the early 90s. But all these possibilities came crashing down on that fateful day in April of 1994. After learning of Michelle's tragic history, the Shark Files host found a Facebook account belonging to her sister, Kirsten. And there they noted dozens of memorial posts for Michelle. And it seems that Kirsten posts about Michelle on the anniversary of her death, on her birthday, and random days in between as well. And even on posts that are not dedicated to Michelle, Kirsten always finds a way to kind of include her sister's memory. And it's both heartbreaking to see that, but also inspiring to see the love that Kirsten had for her sister. And in the Shark Files update blog, it's pointed out that in Kirsten's posts, the sisters and other family members talk about Michelle as if they know how she died, as if there's, you know, no mystery surrounding her passing. And with this information, Shark Files listeners have begun to believe that Michelle ended her own life that night by jumping from the sandstone cliffs. They believe she sustained the impact injuries in the fall and severely broke her leg. And these injuries would have incapacitated Michelle as she was dragged out to sea, potentially into a nearby riptide and thrown against rocks and the sea floor where her neck was broken and she ultimately drowned. As for her severe leg injuries, it's believed that marine life fed upon Michelle's body, eventually causing the leg to break away from the rest of her body. In fact, there is a highly respected guide to femoral shaft fractures called the Winquist-Hansen classification of femoral shaft fractures. And based on this guide, a type 2 or 3 fracture could absolutely explain a bone that looks pointed and cut like bamboo, as we were kind of explaining earlier. And to be clear, this presumption has never been officially confirmed by any of Michelle's family, but there is one clue to the case that may confirm this theory. According to multiple Reddit users discussing the update, the Michelle Von Emster Wikipedia page was at some point updated with the line, quote, "After the investigation, the family knows the true cause of death and has chosen to keep the details private." Next to this sentence was a notice that a citation was needed. A Reddit user called Salamander Queen then commented that the edit history for the page had the following explanation for the changes. Quote, "Removed copyright infringing image. Updated details about my sister's death. No mystery on this one." Now, it is important to note that this is no longer on the wiki, and it cannot be verified if it was even there to begin with. But if it was, we also cannot prove that it actually was one of Michelle's sisters that made the update. Still, though, it seems that all signs from Michelle's family and friends point to the same conclusion, that Michelle's trauma was just, you know, too much for her to bear. And she had been through so much in her life. And that trauma and hardship was the cause of her death in one way or another. Today, Michelle's legacy lives on through her younger sister, Teresa, who exposed the world to the abuse that Michelle sadly endured by the Roman Catholic Church. In Teresa's article, she states that although her whole family is obviously devastated by her death, they say, quote, "We are happy Michelle finally has peace. Peace that was stolen from her at age 15 by Father Greg Engels. Peace my family still doesn't have." Really powerful quote there. Teresa also wrote that her parents carry a lot of the shame over not doing a better job protecting Michelle. They also feel angry at how the church manipulated them and protected Father Engels. Cannot imagine carrying those feelings. As an adult with two children of her own, Teresa started the Wounded Birds Ministry, which is a website that helps educate, encourage, and support people living through chronic or trauma-induced mental illnesses. Wounded Birds Ministry offers support groups and educational resources to those in need. According to Teresa, her mission is to, quote, "compassionately educate on the true nature of mental illnesses, encourage with hope, prayer, and spiritual insights, and to support those who live with either a chronic or trauma-related mental illness." Teresa's own experiences with bipolar disorder and related traumas help her move beyond the often simplistic answers the Christian community offers for mental illness. She loves to share hope, knowledge, and skills that she's learned along her own journey to health. She runs several support groups that cover a variety of topics, including core skills for mental illness and trauma groups related to sexual assault and abuse, abortion, and broken relationships. Teresa is very open about her own mental illness and how the chaotic household in which she was raised, with witnessing the pain that Michelle suffered, triggered her bipolar disorder at a surprisingly early age of just 10 years old. And though Michelle never got the justice that she deserved, Teresa works with others so that they can avoid going through the same suffering that her sister did. And we will definitely have the Wounded Birds Ministry linked below for those who would benefit from it or know someone who could possibly benefit from it. I just love when families take a tragic loss like this and try to do something positive for the world in their loved one's memory. It's truly such a beautiful way to honor those who we've lost. And, you know, it takes a lot of strength, I think, in your time of need and suffering to try to create a resource to help others.
So after looking at everything all together, do you guys think there's any other theories than she went to the cliffs that night, ultimately took her own life?
I mean, the family has never confirmed whether or not they believe that. It certainly seems that that's what they think. And
maybe, though.
Yeah. I want to, you know, it's hard because I don't want to, if they've already accepted that and they know better than anyone else, I normally go with what the family believes. And I will say that above all else, I do believe that. However, I'm not 100% convinced.
Sure. I just have a couple questions.
Yeah.
Because there's a couple things that stand out to me that maybe point to other theories. For one, what do you guys think about the fact that she's found naked versus why wasn't she found with what she was wearing?
Yeah, that's a very strange point as well.
Unless she was...
Well, people...
She only had, like, why wasn't any, she was clearly about to go to a concert, so she had to have some type of clothing on, right?
Yeah.
The coat.
But I have heard of, I don't know the statistics around it, but I know I've heard of people committing suicide naked.
That's interesting that you bring that up, because that was actually my next point.
I think we have talked about other cases and debated this before.
Well, here's what's interesting about that. So this information is coming from Robert Simon, who is a former clinical professor of psychiatry and director of psychiatry and law at Georgetown University School of Medicine. He was one of the foremost scholars in forensic psychiatry and the study of suicide. And before his death in 2016, he released a paper actually in 2008 called Naked Suicide. And he offers some insight about people, you know, making the decision to end their life while naked. So he says, when it comes to women, naked suicide is considered exceptionally rare due to the popular concept of feminine modesty carrying on even through death. Conventional wisdom has it that a woman found hanging naked is most likely a homicide or a staged suicide, he said, adding that is not unheard of for women to hang themselves or induce asphyxia by other means while naked. A suicide victim's nudity could indicate a number of things about their psychological state or reasons for taking their own life. Some of the psychological themes present at naked suicides include the idea of rebirth or cleansing, atonement for guilt or anger, and the desire to traumatize survivors even further. Knowing that one's body will be found naked and taking the trouble to remove clothing has psychological import. The state of an individual's clothing, including partial undress and nakedness, can provide important clues in a psychological autopsy. A naked suicide can also be an expression of vulnerability, utter despair, desolation, and worthlessness. So again, it goes back to, it is incredibly rare. With this, I think it's definitely more possible because of who she was. She was very, as her sister put it, she was kind of, you know, she's kind of a hippie. And I can definitely see her potentially in those final moments having this thought of like, I want to return, you know, I want to leave this earth natural the way that I came in. That like whole thought, you know,
yourself.
Yeah. But my one issue with that is, where's her clothes and where's any of the items that she was wearing prior to that happening?
Well, she could have put them in the ocean and they're in the ocean for all we know.
Very true. That is a possibility.
Thrown them in.
But then why is her purse 2 miles away? That's the other big question I have, is why is her purse over there? The drift test was done. That didn't add up.
I agree with you. I mean, we can sit here and say she could have done this, she could have done that. But that's the frustrating part, is no one knows, and we will probably never know.
We won't ever know, likely. But I do go back to, she's talking about a coworker stalking her. And this person claims to have been with her literally the day before she dies. Could he have been stalking her the following day? Maybe things didn't end the way that he wanted them to when they were together, and therefore he was angry and stalking her all of the next day, was watching her.
Like followed her to the cliffs,
and he was there with her at the cliffs.
Possible.
And ultimately, he tried to make advances on her, in which they, a struggle or something happened. He pushes her off of the cliff. It looks like it's a suicide. He then goes and plants her purse, or throws the rest of her belongings off the cliff, or takes them. I mean, I could see a stalker like him taking something of personal from her, and then planting the purse there.
I mean, like I said, it is possible. I think it's probably unlikely. I keep going back to her friend saying that she seemed to be in a bad headspace and didn't want to go home. She has her drop her off at the beach. I think those hours leading up to this could have been spent, which we don't know exactly when it happened, but could have been spent kind of reflecting and thinking about things. And
yeah, could
be. I mean, that's a valid theory. It could have been, but I think when you look at the bigger picture, there really isn't any evidence for that. We don't even know that she was for sure being stalked. That's just what someone said. And when you look at her life and all the trauma she went through, and then having leukemia on top of that, and addiction.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she lived an incredibly troubled, traumatic life. And
so just to clarify too, she had told friends about a possible stalker.
Yeah.
But we don't know for sure from her. Yeah. I guess just
they're probably telling the truth. She probably did have a stalker. I wish police would have followed up on that and looked more into it. Because it is possible. That theory you lay out could have happened. I just in my mind think it's a lot less likely.
Her bag was there for 24 hours, wasn't taken.
That can happen too.
A lot of people are caught up on that. That doesn't really, it'd be weird if it was there for a week.
Yeah.
Like 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
True.
When a lot of that is during the night.
Right.
You know, we don't know exactly. I guess they did say it was in a populated area, but
still 24 hours isn't that long of a time.
Or like I said, someone could have looked in it and seen that there wasn't anything worth taking to them. And I don't think that's like a hugely vital piece. I see where people are coming from, though. I don't know.
I mean, it doesn't really do any good to like go too far down the murder route at this point, because she's gone no matter what. Yeah. And I do agree with you that just her life story is so tragic and so horrible. And just there is so much trauma there that I can't imagine dealing with that and what your mental state would be like. And I mean, she was about to go to a concert, and, you know, maybe there is, maybe substances potentially.
Yeah, we don't even know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There could have been substances being used. So maybe her mind state was just not. I mean, those can definitely make you spiral. So there's a lot of other factors that kind of, when you look at all together, it makes sense.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was worth mentioning. Just, I don't know.
No,
I just wish authorities would look at everything just a little bit deeper and just consider, well, it seems very clear what this is, but is there a possibility based on other evidence or interviews we've done with people that knew her to suggest there could have been somebody who would want to harm her.
Well, above all else, it's a failure of the medical examiner who called.
Yeah.
Called it so early on, was so confident in it when he had no idea what the fuck he was talking about.
No, literally lying about.
And, you know, the police followed his lead. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Again, probably multiple failings on this case that may or may not have gotten us all the facts, all the information. And maybe there is more to this case than what we know. Mm-hmm. Well, there is for sure. But as far as like murder or somebody else being involved, but.
Yeah.
I mean,
either way you slice it, she was failed majorly. Even if it was a suicide, she was failed horribly by the Catholic Church. And I understand where, you know, her parents and they're traumatized by it too, by the church and what they've been through. And obviously they feel horrible regret now, but a lot of adults failed her in her life. And it's just beyond tragic. I really just feel for her and this family. And I'm glad that they've been able to accept that in their minds, she's at peace now. I know that probably means the world to them, although they did say that it's peace that they will never have. It's heartbreaking. It's just horrible.
It absolutely is. Really not much else to say about it.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah.
Well, we definitely want to hear from all of you on, you know, your thoughts on this case. What makes the most sense to you? Let us know in the comments.
Absolutely. And
that is going to be it for us today. We will be back next week to discuss another case.
And until then,
keep on taking your mind a mile higher.
See you next time.